So, thank you for the rich and interesting minds that created so many very, very problematic notes, full of wisdom, full of questions, full of circles and loops. And have you all been to a yeshiva, or like? So, but anyway, Joseph and I have been looking at the questions, and this evening we'll try and address some of the questions. We can't address all of them, but some of them for sure, and some of them do really get to the heart of Dharma. And so, although I'm joking a bit, I mean, I do thank you all. And we'll have time for some more questions from you this evening as well. And so we decided just both of us to kind of freely respond to the questions that we got. So the first question that I want to respond to, and it's really starting at the top of the mountain and working our way downwards, because usually we feel we have to go from the bottom of the mountain and climb up to the top. Well, the first question was about awakening, first question that I want to deal with. And it has, there are two questions actually. One is about conditioned and unconditioned. And the second is, in a way, a cry for the heart that says, just don't tell me all about this stuff of awakening. I don't want to know about it. It just produces resistance and anger, and I don't want to be enlightened. I'm just fine. So I want to just make a few comments about that. First of all, any talk about awakening is a bit like the image I gave the other day about metta. It's a bit like a cool drop of water hitting a hot plate, and the reaction is psh. So if I even say the word nibbana, nirvana, everyone here would have reactions of hopes, of expectations, of memories, of thoughts, of longing, or of reactions, or of negative reactions to it. Tends to produce by the nature of, because it's we put it up there, so it is bound to create some big responses and thoughts. And the other problem is it is not something that we can understand in language anyway. So all language can only, coming from thought, can really only kind of reach or point towards it. And it cannot be that we can put awakening in a box of any concept. Otherwise it's not awakening. It's a concept. About. So that's a kind of in brackets, but it can produce a lot of stuff around it. And so that's to be understood. But this lady or man says, I don't want it. It's annoying. It's something I don't want to know about. And I think here there's something that's really rather deep, which is saying, I don't trust. The world I know is the world of a person, is the world of a self, with the loves and the joys and the sadness of being a human being, and the attachments and my family and what I want to do in my life and my whole life. And awakening seems to be a disintegration of everything that I hold as a human being, and I will accept dukkha if I have to. It was kind of inbuilt into that question. And it's very understood, because awakening is from the known to the unknown. We are always frightened of the unknown. We are always, it's like death, we always have a very complex and kind of push-pull relationship to the unknown. I want it, but I'm scared of it because I'm going to have to give up what I know. I'm going to have to give up the self that I know. But we can suggest something else. That awakening may not need this sense of either I'm a human being with my hopes and my loves and my, or I'm awakened and I'm somehow turned into a kind of an angel flying off into the sky. And what about a middle ground, another ground in which I am a loving, caring, I do cry and I do love, but awakening is the ground from which I cry and I love. Meaning, the ocean is the ocean, but the waves are also there. And the waves and the ocean are in relationship to one to another. There's a different view of awakening. Is not having to give up being a human being, but taking being a human being very, very lightly. Like they say, like the quote, one of my favorite quotes is, why do angels fly? Because they take themselves so lightly. So I understand the resistance, but maybe it's coming from that place of fear of what I might have to give up. And one thing that is for sure, every time, I mean, this is universal. If you have to give up something on the level of, renounce something on the level of the person, the level of what is me, the definitions, the possessions, the attachments, it is always a problem until you've done it. And then what a relief. And you never know beforehand the relief you'll get when you do it. So beforehand it feels scary, like giving up things feels scary. When you've done it, universally, the lightness is a real big relief, and you don't know that beforehand. So the conditioned and the unconditioned, I don't want to get into it too much because it can lead to a lot of concepts, but it just, to me, it's the most, really the most inspiring way of describing awakening. It's uniquely Buddhist. It's uniquely in the Dharma to re-describe the world and us as simply a flow of conditions that make more conditions, which is empty. It's conditions making more conditions. And that's what a human being is, and that's what everything else is. And this view leading, so okay, there is the unconditioned, which is beyond the sense that everything is just a result of conditions. So it's out of that picture. It's out of the conditioned world. It's somewhere else. But it's just a very inspiring way of looking at things. And if you can sense in the dynamic nature of your experience that everything is simply a flow of conditions that condition something else, that condition something else, that because this moment, then the next moment, because this moment looks like this, then the next moment looks like that, because I am like this, this moment, so I am like that, the next moment. Every moment is creating the next, and there really then isn't anything there. So if you get a little taste of it, then you're ready, in a sense, on the path to the unconditioned. So that's sort of starting from the top. And your turn.
Well, I'll just continue with this theme of starting from the top, and picking up on Stephen's comment about how it's always a little fearsome, the thought of giving up something before we do it and the relief afterwards. I had that experience very strongly the first time I was in India and decided to shave my head. And the thought of it at first was, oh my God. And afterwards, it was what a relief. And from the perspective now, it was good training. So renunciation serves many purposes. One of the questions was about the Pali term sampajana, which is often translated as clear comprehension or clear knowing, and it's used frequently in the texts. And the question was, you know, why we hadn't mentioned it specifically. So I thought I'd just speak a little bit about what that term means, because it is an important part of our mindfulness practice. In fact, the two terms in Pali are often used together, sati sampajana, which is mindfulness and clear comprehension. And it's helpful to consider it because it expands our understanding of what mindfulness means. So sampajana has different aspects. One aspect is clear knowing or clear comprehension of the purpose or the motivation behind our acts. So it's not enough simply to be mindful of what we're doing. We need to be mindful of what we're doing, but that includes an understanding, well, what's the motivation behind it? Is it a skillful motivation? Is it an unskillful motivation? This whole question of becoming aware of the motivation behind our actions, whether actions of speech, of body, of mind, is at the heart of the teachings. It's at the heart of our practice. The Dalai Lama once said, everything rests on the tip of motivation, right? Because that's really what constitutes the whole flow of our unfolding karma. And he said that the true measure of an act is not its success or failure, but the motivation behind it. Well, that's a very un-Western-like statement, mm-hmm. You know, where we tend to measure things in terms of their success or failure. But from the perspective of wisdom, the motivation is much more important. It's not always easy to know our motivations. Motivation is a subtle aspect of our inner experience. Sometimes they're obvious, you know, where there may be a motivation of compassion or love or kindness or greed or anger. Sometimes that's very clear. Sometimes they're more subtle and sometimes they're mixed. You know, we can have a whole series of conflicting motivations. I had one experience of this very strongly. I was on retreat and I was doing some Dharma reading and I came across a story that I thought my colleague Sharon Salzberg would like to use in her book. Now, as you probably know, for Dharma teachers, a good story is gold. You know, we're always on the hunt for a good story. But my first thought, I read this and I thought, oh, that'll be a great story for Sharon. And my very next thought was, no, I'm going to keep this story for myself. And then my third thought was, oh, that's just being selfish. I need to give her this story. And my fourth thought was, I'll give her the story, but I'm going to tell her my whole process so she'll feel a little indebted to me. So she would understand the great sacrifice I was making. So as I was watching my mind just go through all this, I began to wonder, you know, where in this whole mix was there purity of motive? And I realized that there was one, and it was in the very first thought. You know, the first thought was just the pure, yeah, it'd be a great story for her. And I realized that even though there was this whole other sequence that took place, because I could be aware of them, I could let them come and go and return to that first moment of generosity and offer it from that place. So all of this happens when we become aware of our motives. If we're unaware, then we just play out whatever conditioning happens to be present. A very valuable place to pay attention to motive is before speech. Have you noticed how often words just seem to tumble out of our mouths? This would be a great practice. You know, just to have enough awareness before we speak. And it just takes a moment. It just takes a moment's recollection. Okay, what's motivating the speech? Is it kindness? Is it metta? Is it causing divisiveness? Is it causing harmony? So this is part of clear comprehension, awareness of motive. The second aspect is not only do we want to be practicing wholesome motivations and wholesome actions, clear comprehension also means knowing the suitability at any particular time for it. So we may be doing something wholesome, but it may not be the right time. And the Buddha talked about this in many different situations, but again with speech, his guidelines, basic guidelines, were speak what is true and what is useful. Because something might be true, but at the particular time, it might not be the useful thing to say. So our awareness, our mindfulness, really has to become very broad. It's not just creeping along, lifting, moving, placing, although that training can be very helpful. Mindfulness and clear comprehension means we take in the world around us. We take in the context, right, of where we are and what we're doing. We become aware of our motivation. We become aware of the suitability of the particular action. The third aspect of clear comprehension is knowing the proper domain for our awareness, the proper arena for our awareness. And in this regard, it's what we've been practicing. The Buddha spoke of the four foundations of mindfulness being the proper domain. We want to keep our attention within these four foundations and not necessarily having the mind go out into the world of sense objects unmindfully. We don't want to be lost, you know, in the world around us. We want to stay mindful of what is happening. The fourth aspect of clear comprehension is the one most closely associated with wisdom, and it's in some way, it's just at the very heart of our practice and of awakening, of the whole path of awakening. And that is the clear comprehension that's associated with wisdom, and in this case, particularly understanding the difference between wrong view and right view. Wrong view of self, right view of understanding the selfless nature of phenomena. The uprooting of wrong view of self, in Pali it's called Sakkaya Ditti. This is what's uprooted at the first stage of enlightenment, right, where we see through this personality belief. But even before that, in our practice of mindfulness, of clear comprehension, we're learning to see things, to be with things, without adding the extra dimension of identifying with them. There is a big difference between being mindful of anger and taking it to be my anger. I'm angry. There's a big difference between feeling love and taking it to be my love. I'm loving. The I is always extra. So clear comprehension, as we apply it in our practice of mindfulness, is just to keep a watch out for all those times in experience when we're adding the I, the sense of I, claiming things as I, to the mix. In one teaching the Buddha gave to his son, Rahula, very clear instruction. He said, everything should be seen with perfect wisdom. This is not mine, this is not I, this is not myself. So that refers to everything. Right? Our bodies, what's happening in the mind, this is not mine, this is not I, this is not myself. So this is the last dimension of clear comprehension where we're really refining our understanding of this wise view. I'll just close this little piece with something that relates this idea of right view to what Stephen was talking about in response to the question of awakening and maybe being afraid of giving something up. This is an example I've been giving for 40 years. And although I know a lot of you have heard some of my talks on tape, you're basically a new audience. So I feel quite comfortable about bringing in this old... And actually, I'm not even sure whether in Israel you have the same name for the constellation. Do you use the Big Dipper? Is that... Okay, the big wagon. Okay, so that's a pretty easy constellation to see in the sky, right? So we go out at night and we look up at the sky and the big wagon. Okay, this is the next to the last night of the retreat. So this is going to be like a final exam. So this is the question for your final exam. Is there really a big wagon up in the sky? There's no big wagon. Big wagon is a concept. It's an idea that we put on a certain pattern of stars, right? And it kind of looks like a wagon. We put a name on it. And the name is helpful because it actually helps us recognize it. And in fact, from the big wagon, you can find the North Star, and if you're out in the middle of the ocean, you have to navigate. You can use that. So it's a useful concept. But it's a concept. There's no big wagon there. Joseph, Stephen, self, is like big wagon. Right? It's a convenient designation for a pattern. The understanding of selflessness is that it's only a designation. It's a designation for the pattern. There's nothing in and of itself that is the self, just like there's no big wagon. But here's the interesting part. Go out at night, look up at the sky, and see if it's possible not to see the big wagon. It's very difficult. We've been so trained to see in a certain way that our mind just automatically picks out those stars, sees the pattern. So if it's that difficult not to see big wagon, it's no wonder you have to come to a retreat in order to not see self, which is much more deeply habituated. Okay, I think I'll leave it at this. Your turn.
There was one or two questions really about what to do in extreme situations where things are very difficult, or where dukkha is very strong. For example, dealing with pain, someone writes, I stopped intentionally focusing on the pain, that is, deconstructing the pain and working on it with mindfulness, because I noticed I'm doing it out of the wish to alleviate the pain and wishing relief from it, which was counterproductive. So would you recommend going into the pain or doing something more open, like there is a body? And another question also about emotional pain. Someone asked, if you lost even an advanced practitioner, if you lost someone close to you, would you feel the pain? Or, as a super advanced, a Buddha, would the Buddha not feel pain if someone close separated or passed away? And I think that it to me is an important question, because it's helping us to understand the possibility here, and not to be an illusion that mindfulness is a kind of medicine that we can apply to everything and it will fix things. When mindfulness is used in pain clinics, for example, in different parts of the world, and when we use it ourselves, and even in the instructions you might have heard, there is quite a skill. It's really more like learning a musical instrument. Mindfulness is not something like kind of on-off. If you hit it with mindfulness, it'll sort it out. It is not like that. So, for example, we have to understand that if the pain is strong, the mindfulness may not be able to hold it in attention with non-identification. It just may be too strong. And the mindfulness is not yet strong enough. So there is an imbalance. The pain is too strong. The mindfulness doesn't touch it. The obvious example is the dentist. You're sitting in a dentist chair. But I can be very, I've been on a retreat, so no problem. I don't need injections. Boom. So I've been through that a few times. Sometimes I can manage, but mostly I say, no, I'll have the injection here. Actually, what helps is focusing on the feet, because it's far away from the head, or the teeth. So I go right down far, far, far away as I can, and go mindfully down there to the feet somehow, and that somehow helps to take away the attention from the teeth. But there's a wisdom here which is important for all of us to understand, I would say, really how to apply mindfulness in relation to difficult situations. And we have to be, we have to understand it. That is, if the mindfulness awareness is not powerful enough, so we can do other things. For example, be aware of non-pain areas. Yes, be aware of there is a body, which gives a little bit of a wider perspective than homing in all the time on the pain. It helps to kind of step back into a wider place where the pain isn't quite as dominant. Or, yes, touch the pain, but touch and go. Knowing the pain is very strong, just touch and go. Because if you stay there and the mindfulness is not very strong, the pain will suck you in. And you will identify with it, you will try and stop it, you will be busy with it, and it becomes then a solid thing called my pain, I'm trying to stop it. Or we can use breath to breathe through the pain, that's another kind of way. So just kind of understanding a little bit more that we're talking about like learning a musical instrument and not a kind of attitude of mindfulness will always deal with everything in some way. So understanding this, and sometimes people say, oh, well, I'm working with pain, working with pain, working with pain, working with pain. I have to say, stop. Enough. Change your position. Don't stay, as I said the other day, don't be a hero if you're a zero. Just stop. It's enough. There's enough suffering in the world. In the name of liberation, piled on more and more and more and more. So I think that the purpose of this is this kind of short review is really to explore the use of this in our life as a much richer field of a power in us, and know how to use it wisely and not the kind of simply too simple. The other question is also an interesting one, and people often ask, well, aren't Buddhists kind of turning into machines? you deal with emotion and you deal with pain and so you become a neutral person. Neutral sensations, then neutral person. And it's not at all like that. There's a beautiful line from T.S. Eliot that says, detachment, attachment and detachment grow in the same hedge, means gader chai. They grow in the same hedge as indifference, which is adishut. But they're as different from each other as life is to death. So we're not learning adishut, indifference. On the contrary, we're actually getting close to the flow of change experience, including the flow of emotion in us. And we can cry, and we can laugh, more easily. I cry more easily, much more easily now than ever before I started to practice. It's just delight, let the tears come. Let the laughter come. It comes and it goes. It's being in a flow of emotional life. It's being part of, a participator in, the flow of energies and changes and feelings. But they don't stick. They don't hold us prisoner. And that's a very big difference. We are there with the changes, but not imprisoned by them. So in relation to the question about attachment and someone close, there's a story about a Tibetan student that saw his teacher crying because he lost his son. And the student said, teacher, master, why are you crying? This is all illusion, isn't it? And the teacher said, yes, but this is the most painful illusion of all of them. So of course we can cry, and we do cry, and we do feel the sadness, and sometimes overwhelming sadness. The Buddha's long ears are an image of hearing the cry of the world, not being adishut, but being there with the cry of the world. But it doesn't need to stick. It doesn't need to work inside us. It doesn't need to land and generate a great deal of victim mind and working on it and thoughts about it and not sleeping at night and turning it and turning it in the mind and getting it stuck inside us. So that would be the difference.
Anything?
Yeah. Just as Stephen was talking, I was debating in my mind whether to say what I'm still debating about, whether to say.
Yes.
tree.
Usually, I talk about this one-on-one because it's really very delicate, and I appreciate the delicacy of it. But I'll express it to you and hold it in the spirit of investigation rather than conclusion. Okay? So it's just a way of investigating some very tender places, tender emotions within us. And at first came to my mind when I read two different things in the suttas. One, the opening paragraph of the Satipatthana Sutta, where the Buddha says this is the direct way for the overcoming of grief, of sorrow, of lamentation, for the purification of the mind, you know, and so forth. So clearly he's saying, you know, that he had overcome these states, that these states did not arise in him. And then elsewhere, there was a description of the Buddha's, could say, feelings when his two chief disciples died, who died before him, Sariputta and Moggallana. And he made the comment, oh, the Sangha now feels empty, now that these two great disciples have died. So it's very interesting to me to put these two next to one another. What does it mean that he had overcome sorrow and lamentation and grief on the one hand, and yet on the other hand he was really expressing a great poignancy of loss? And so I began just to look, both in my own experience and then in working with other people, at trying to understand the difference between the feeling of grief and the feeling of loss. Because clearly, the Buddha was expressing the sadness at the loss of his two closest disciples. And yet, he was free of grief. And so what does that mean? You know, what would that mean in our own lives when we experience a deep loss? And here's where it's tender and it's delicate, because often this is one of the most painful times of our lives. You know, when we lose people that are close to us. And I think it would be interesting, if you're interested, and many people are not. So, it's just if there's interest in this exploration, to begin to open to the feeling of loss, which is painful. And as we know, it's not easy to be accepting of painful things, even something as simple as a pain in the knee. It takes practice to get okay with that, to say, okay, this is okay, let me feel it. Well, this emotional pain is much worse than the pain in the knee. It hurts. It's painful. Can we practice opening to it, accepting the painful feeling of loss? And I just began to explore how very often the feeling of grief is part of the process of coming to accept the painful feeling of the loss. By understanding it in this way, I think it's possible to approach the loss, especially people with, you know, some background in mindfulness and awareness, to actually approach the loss more immediately. We see, yes, this is the process. Need to open to this feeling. The acceptance comes usually for most people anyway over time, but it's really a question of how long it takes us to come to this feeling of acceptance of loss. And I think the meditation can be of tremendous value and tremendous healing when we see that's actually what the process is about. Does this make sense? But again, I've worked with people in times of great loss, and I've seen some people are capable of doing this, are interested in doing it, and others are not. Others, it's, as Stephen was saying, it's too painful and just need to back off and need to go through a longer process. And so we each find our own way through it. I just found it illuminating to understand exactly what the process is. You know, to see that it is possible to come more immediately to that feeling.
I'm going to answer a very short question and then give it back to give the microphone to you two. You have a pile of questions, yeah, which get to the real thing about awareness and consciousness and non-dual and dual. So we're all waiting. Oh, this is the interlude. This is like the popcorn before the film. The question is very simple, but it does need some reflection. Can you explain more about the difference between thought and insight or truth? And it's quite an interesting question, actually, because we have been looking at thought and somehow inviting wisdom. But are they the same thing? Where does wisdom lie, if not in a thought? And therefore, should we just watch a thought that passes, comes up and passes and goes away? Are we losing all the wisdom that way? Just goes down the drain. We leave it all in the main door. And we go out like fool on the hill. So, clearly, we're talking about two areas of knowing which can be overlapping, of course. It's not that they are two compartments. One is a thought, and it's destined for the rubbish bin. And one is insight and truth, and we collect it as sampajana. But insight doesn't come really from the same place as thought. Thought is a result of chains of experience, of conditions, of memory, of previous thoughts, of what we learn. It's material that arises in the Buddhist psychology. It's a sense, sixth sense. Like what's coming through the eyes, what's coming from the memory, is it like what's coming through the eyes, information that arises. And indeed, it can carry very, obviously very valuable insights for us as well, that we gain some clarity. But the insight or wisdom is wisdom that changes us. It has a different quality altogether. It puts us in another place. It shifts the way we view ourselves and the world. And that's a shift which is not sitting in thought. It's a shift in the way we use our mind, the way we see, the way we know ourselves and the world. And it comes from another place. It comes immediately. It's the kind of aha. Aha. I must, in brackets, say I've had this experience, you know, many times where people have said to me, that was a great talk you gave the other night. And if I ask, and what did I say? I don't remember. Because the talk is in maybe, the content is in the level of information, but something has been inspired in the person. Some shift has happened in the way the person holds reality. And that comes from another place. It comes, can be immediate. It comes from a place we don't even know. It can come in a surprise. It can come when we're not expecting it. It isn't... You can't even fish for it, like a man fishing for a fish with a line. You can't fish for it. Ladug. I want wisdom. Why doesn't the fish take the... It's often it just arises by itself when the time is right. Of course, we can do a lot to make the wisdom have, to make ourselves accessible to the wisdom, to make ourselves available to wisdom. And that's what we're doing here. We're making ourselves available to it. But exactly how the wisdom arises and when and what is not quite in a linear cause and effect. Whereas a thought, we know, creates another thought similar. Like the image I have of Papancha is in Winnie the Pooh, who, by the way, had this wonderful line about himself, which is very wise, when he said, "I'm a Pooh of very little brain." And that's very wise. And that tells you what the difference between thought and wisdom. But in the Winnie the Pooh books, there's this picture of Rabbit, and every time Rabbit comes to a tea party, brings all friends, relations, cousins, smaller cousins, little cousins, and you see this long line of smaller, going down to the smallest insects, and they all join the tea party. So that for me is a thought. Thoughts bring their cousins, and then the uncles and aunts, and more cousins and more cousins, and they go right down to little ones. And wisdom, as I say, comes from another place. And we can't design wisdom, but we can invite it. We can be open to it. We can allow it. And we can move ourselves towards it. It's not even in the same as intuition. Although intuition is close to it or is nearby, is a sort of neighbor. Intuition is, in a way, not in the realm of thought. But wisdom is not quite the same as intuition. They're overlapping also. So, that's a few words.
How can you distinguish when it's wisdom and when it's just
a thing? I think you can distinguish it by, in a sense, the sense that you're in a different place. That's what the way I would... You're in a different place. Can be you feel more free, or you feel more open, or you feel more understanding, or you feel more. There's something happens to your the way you look at things. It's a shift in. It's a shift rather than a conclusion, which comes and goes. I was the worst Dharma student in so many retreats, because I wrote pages and pages and pages and pages and pages and pages and pages of retreat after retreat after retreat. I have files, this, and I don't look at them because they're full of thoughts and conclusions, and I just don't need them. I don't. They're really still in a filing cabinet. I wrote tons in retreats, even though I was told not to. And there they are. I don't look at them. So it's the wisdom you really do is valuable, and the thoughts, the conclusions, well, they can be sometimes helpful, but there's a limit to them.
Time's up. Okay. Okay, there were quite a few questions about awareness, consciousness, non-dual awareness, dual awareness, unconditioned awareness, conditioned awareness. And so I'll just ramble a bit and see what comes out. First, to say that the term awareness itself is very problematic. Awareness is not the translation of any particular Pali term. It's an English word that we use in many different ways. And because we use it in so many different ways, it gets confusing about what we mean. So sometimes we use awareness to mean consciousness. Somebody's aware as opposed to unconscious. Sometimes we mean mindfulness. Are you mindful of the object? Are you aware of the object? Sometimes awareness, as I mentioned the other night, sometimes it's talked about as an unconditioned awareness, not associated with any of the aggregates. So you find that description, for example, in some of the Tibetan teachings and in some of the Thai forest tradition. So it's just very helpful in using the term to actually define, at least to yourself, what you mean by it, because it's not always clear. In the questions, there were the comments that sometimes in the observing of objects and often with the mental noting, it feels like it's creating a distance, you know, and a separation, a sense of duality. One of the problems in speaking about meditation and giving instructions, and I've mentioned this to several of you in interviews, we use a lot of watching language. We'll talk about observing, notice, note, right? And so the very language we're using suggests a looking at, which itself creates a kind of duality. And as I've mentioned to many of you, feel a much better languaging of our process would be feeling language rather than watching language. So for example, if I'm moving my arm, if I say, well, observe the movement, you know, it's kind of, I'm on the outside trying to track it, and it's very burdensome. And I did walking meditation like that for years, you know, where I wasn't literally looking at my feet or legs, but it was as if I were observing it from the outside. Then at a certain point, something shifted, a moment of wisdom, and I realized it's not about observing the movement, it's feeling the movement. In the feeling of the movement, that's from the inside. There's no separation. There's no duality. We're really one with the movement and feeling it. So as we bring that kind of understanding to our practice, this dualistic sense collapses. And we're just in the flow of experience, feeling it, arising and passing and changing. So that's one arena in which we can begin to make the shift from a more dualistic perception to a non-dualistic one. There's a more subtle aspect, and I talked about it a bit the other night, and this is really quite subtle. There will always be a dualistic perception if we're viewing things from the perspective of I. Because if there's I, then there's other. So as soon as there's an I, there's automatically a dualistic way of looking at the world and being in the world. The place, perhaps the most hidden place that the I resides, I want to take a step back. The I, the self, is not something that's there that we have to get rid of. That's like trying to get rid of the big wagon. It's not there in the first place. It's just a concept. So what we have to do in our practice is not to get rid of the I, not to get rid of the self, but rather to see how moment to moment we're creating the sense of I. Moment to moment we're creating a felt sense of someone, some self, every time we're identifying with what's arising. If we're identifying with a thought, it becomes my thought. If we identify with sadness, it becomes my sadness. If we become identified with mindfulness, I'm being mindful. These factors in themselves are selfless. Sadness sads. Anger angers. The thought is the thinker. Every element is simply fulfilling its own function. It's when we are not seeing that and identifying with whatever's arising, that identification with the object is what creates the sense of self and the sense of duality. Are we together so far? The place that we most deeply and habitually identify with, and it's very hard to see, we identify with knowing. We identify with consciousness. Even as we become aware, yeah, thoughts are coming and going, and emotions come and go, and sensations and sounds and sights, we're really seeing the impersonal nature of all of that, but still I'm the one who's knowing it. So that's the place, that's like the last hideout of self. So the question, which I addressed a little bit the other night, how do we cut through this identification with knowing, with consciousness? Different traditions talk about this in different ways, but all of them, whether it's the Vipassana tradition in Theravada, whether it's the Thai forest tradition, whether it's Zen or Tibetan, all of them are geared to breaking that identification with the knowing so that there's no longer a knower apart from experience, because that is the basic dualistic perception. In classic Vipassana practice, I think I talked about this the first night. What's happening moment after moment? In every moment, there's knowing an object arising and passing away. Knowing of a sight, knowing of a sound, a smell, a thought. And it's happening very, very rapidly. This pairwise progression of knowing an object, knowing an object, knowing an object. At first, it's the objects that are most obvious, right? Because they're not as subtle. But as our practice gets refined, we begin to actually perceive this pairwise progression that both the knowing and the object are arising and passing in each moment. And so that becomes an experience when our mindfulness is quite strong. When we're actually seeing the rising and passing of consciousness moment to moment to moment to moment along with its object, at that time, there's no identification with it. We see that the consciousness itself is simply part of this impersonal process. Okay. So that's one way of breaking the identification with knowing, when we're seeing the momentariness of consciousness. Part of the questions that were in this group talked about, is awareness conditioned or unconditioned? This is a question that different schools of Buddhism have been arguing about for 2600 years. In the classic Theravada teachings, consciousness is seen as a conditioned arising, conditioned by different causes, arising and passing in each moment. So it's pretty clear in the text that that's how it's seen. There are a few places in the text, very few, but there are one or two places where there is a consciousness described that is unconditioned, apart from this arising and passing of the aggregates. It's called consciousness that's unsupported, unmanifest. So just to give you, you know, one possibility of maybe a way of understanding this, how do we become aware of light? We become aware of light when it lands on something, even something as ephemeral as air, you know, or dust particles. But light, if we shined light, you know, from Pluto into outer space, and it didn't land on anything, we wouldn't see the light. Is that right? Are there scientists among you? And so one way of understanding this unmanifest consciousness might be thinking of it in these terms. The light is there, but it's unmanifest because it's not landing on anything. Mm-hmm. And the Buddha uses, he gives this one example of light coming through a window of a house from different directions, and he keeps asking, how would you be aware of the light? And, oh, I would see it on the western wall. Or, if there's no western wall, on the eastern wall. Finally, it takes everything away. And in that case, one is not seeing the light, but the light is still there. So there's a phrase in a Taoist text, which I really love. It's from Chuang Tzu. I'm talking about this unconditioned awareness. It is, but it doesn't exist. So that's something for you to chew on. It is, but it doesn't exist. What more to say? The last thing just to say about this, as you can tell, this is gets into very subtle realms about which different schools of Buddhism have very different views. if one is holding the understanding or likes the view of an unconditioned awareness, the caution that I would encourage is that you watch for any reification of it as becoming something. Because that's the danger. It's not a thing.
What is reification?
Reification means like a solidifying it. Because freedom is not in becoming identified with this awareness. You don't want to make a home of self in the awareness. And that's one of the dangers of this view. But it's possible to have that understanding without that reification, without identifying with it. Maybe just as one last image to hold, which might help in all this. I had sat a Dzogchen retreat with Sokni Rinpoche. And in the Dzogchen tradition, they really talk about an unconditioned awareness. And somebody came to him and was describing their experience and just describing the great spaciousness, you know, of the experience. And what he said, it was very incisive. He said, it's not exactly spacious. It's not really about spaciousness. It's about groundlessness. So that was really, I thought, a very good distinction. Because spacious as it is already something. Right? It's spatial in some way. Whereas groundlessness is like channel zero. So just in exploring how not to get caught in identification with knowing, with consciousness, to know that it can happen through the very classic Vipassana practice of simply seeing consciousness arising and passing very, very quickly, and so the identification falls away. Or in this other tradition of recognizing the nature of awareness as being groundless. So I think that's... place to end. No, I think I'll say one more thing. Don't think about it. I found that, and I've studied with different teachers in different traditions, often saying not only different things, but often conflicting things. And I have spent a long time tormenting myself with the question, who's right? You know, if they're right, that means they're wrong. And these are all great masters, you know. And it was tormenting. Until I realized that I was asking the wrong question. It's not about who's right. It's about, is this teaching a skillful means for letting go of grasping? Is this teaching a skillful means for letting go of grasping? Because that's where the freedom is. It's not in some metaphysics. I And so I began to use the phrase metaphysics as skillful means, right? Not as statements of truth. As long as we take them to be statements of truth, all of these different opinions create conflict. If we take them all as skillful means, then we can just learn from any tradition and see if it actually helps us to let go. So with that, have a good evening. Mm-hmm.